90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For something that proves to be almost as difficult and frustrating as it is rewarding, gardening continues to be one of America's favorite hobbies. And as the price of groceries rises and the desire to live healthier lives increases, more and more people are turning to organic gardening. But this part of the country has been in and continues to be in a severe drought, despite the rain of recent days. Can you successfully garden organically in a drought? Our guests today say yes, although you may have to become a little creative in your watering. And tonight at 6 p.m., one of those more creative watering methods is being dedicated at the Urban Ministry Center. Through a grant from Organic Gardening Magazine, they have placed a cistern to hold rainwater on their roof for an organic garden tended by some of Charlotte's homeless people. We'll talk about that, about organic gardening in general and about doing so in a drought, with three experts on the topic. First, we welcome back to the program Don Bokelhide, the Community Gardening Program Director at Urban Ministry Center. He's also a variety tester and correspondent for Rodale's Organic Gardening Magazine and teaches a popular six-week outdoor hands-on organic gardening class for Central Piedmont Community College. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Morning.
Your shirt's in bloom.
Yes, very nice. Is it
no
weeds.
Organic garden, organic cotton, I hope. Pam Rook is research editor and head test gardener for Organic Gardening Magazine. Apparently the whole concept of organic gardening was created by the magazine's original editor, J.I. Rodale, who was looking for a more earth-friendly approach to gardening and farming that he dubbed organic gardening back in the 1940s. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome
Thank
to
you.
The program. Nice to have you with us. You're from
Thank
Pennsylvania.
You. Yes, I am.
And we have some tomatoes here, which we'll talk about as we go through the program. And you were saying you don't have tomatoes yet in Pennsylvania.
We don't have tomatoes yet, but we will have plenty of tomatoes in another 3 weeks.
Gosh, your growing season is so far behind. I can't. What part of Pennsylvania are you from?
Emmaus.
Where's that?
Near Allentown.
Okay. And David Goforth is with us. He is the North Carolina State University Cooperative Extension Agent in Cabarrus County, a guy who is called upon by farmers and gardeners alike for advice on making things grow organically and otherwise. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
I know as we go through the show, people will have questions and comments of their own, and you're certainly invited to join us. Our numbers are 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, and you can join us on our blog, wfae.org/Charlotte Blogs. I never can remember it. For those who don't know, we were talking about this cistern that's being dedicated tonight, C-I-S-T-E-R-N, at the Urban Ministry Center. What is a cistern? Who wants to take that?
It's a method of holding water, in this case, rainwater. You collect rainwater off of a roof, and you can do this both in a homeowner situation or commercially. It can be done in residential areas.
Or just a big barrel.
Not necessarily a barrel, but a container. It could be any type of container.
And you don't have to do anything to it to keep the water from not becoming
rainwater algae. Is fairly clean if you flush the first one. Most of the cisterns are built so that the sunlight does not get into them, and if the sunlight doesn't get in there, the algae will not grow.
Okay. What brought the Urban Ministry Center and their cistern to your attention and to the attention of your magazine? Because your magazine has given them a grant to make this happen.
Actually, the magazine is giving the grants with the assistance of Avino and Nature's Path, who are providing a lot of the money for the grants. Mm-hmm. And we did this for the first time in 2007. We had 20 community gardens around the country that received rainwater harvesting systems. So this is the second year we've been doing this. We had 85 applicants, which we went through and decided on the basis of need, of how many people would benefit from the rainwater harvesting systems. And Urban Ministries was one of our winners, one of our 17 winners for 2008. The gardens are around the country, and we actually have two in Uganda this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what are some of the other places, and what qualified them to win your assistance?
Many of them are community gardens. Many of them are inner city, people who are underprivileged, need a little bit of garden space to raise their own fresh food. We have some school gardens. We have one Montessori garden, which is, you know, early childhood education. So this is the only garden we have that is for the homeless. It's,
okay.
it's a really unique situation.
Let me ask a really stupid question. Why do you need assistance? Why does anybody need assistance in constructing and putting in place some sort of a cistern or some sort of a container to collect rainwater, enough rainwater to use in a garden? Why isn't an inflatable swimming pool, seriously, enough? Mm-hmm. Or a couple of buckets on the roof that you pour into little, you know, handheld water cans?
The truth is anybody can do that. You can buy a rain barrel and you can attach it to your gutter.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, the garden happens to be uphill from the rainwater cistern, which makes it a little difficult to get the water out of the cistern and into the garden. And it really required a professional to scope out the situation and just to decide how to make it work.
Now, in a non-drought situation, it seems to me that it would be easy to fill the cistern or keep it filled on a regular basis. But in a drought situation, take away the last several days, what would you do? I mean, you just collect it as you can and use it as sparingly as you can? How do you use it to make the best use of it in a drought situation?
Well, part of it's the size. If you get a good-sized cistern, you'd be able to carry over, and this is the way we typically do it, is we have a bigger area than we could water the whole year. Last year we'd had problems when we didn't have any rain from May through October, but during a year when we normally get a thunderstorm, if you can collect that from that thunderstorm, and if that can water you for a couple of weeks until you get the next thunderstorm, that is the type of system or type of situation where a cistern will really do you well.
So,
now, the other thing we've got here is the last one I've seen installed, the guy actually used it for flushing their commodes and for it could be used for laundry, too. And so some of the bigger cisterns, they put a pump there, they put an overflow, they put collection, and you can run into a little bit of a cost on doing that.
So obviously this container is covered, as you said, because it keeps the sunlight out. How does the water get in?
Well, if you're doing a rain barrel, it's just simply you have an opaque rain barrel. And I use a rain barrel on one of my greenhouses. The only source of water for one of my greenhouses is a rain barrel. But if you can also put one underground, which makes it real easy. But it's just basically an opaque. The way that you've got a pipe that can go in there, or it can just be a downspout, just straight into it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly how John's is set up there.
So when we say cistern and rain barrel, we're talking about pretty much the same thing. Is that right?
Rain barrels are typically smaller size and sometimes they look like a barrel, you know, and then the cisterns can be quite a bit larger. The application I saw was 3,000, 5,000 is very common.
Okay. And Don?
Ours is 1,600. And
1,600 meaning what?
1,600 gallons.
Okay.
It's a big tank. Mm-hmm. And what did you call it? A super-sized rain barrel.
Super-sized, yeah. I have some numbers here.
Sure.
You can gather 600 gallons of water for an inch of rain if you have a roof that's 1,000 square feet, which is about 40 by 25, a typical home roof. So you don't need a whole lot of rain to
get
a pretty good amount of water in your cistern.
And, you know, we're all here to talk about organic gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing organic gardeners do is they look at the big picture. They look at how your garden fits into ecology. At the center, we have a new building with 6,000 square feet of roof. Now, if we don't capture that water, it just rushes like a tidal wave mm-hmm. through our local creeks. We stop some of that water, and then instead of tapping into our drinking water, our treated drinking water that costs a lot of money, we can water our garden. We can grow collards for the soup kitchen just by tapping into the existing resource of our roof.
Now, I heard my mother talk about this a long time ago when I was a kid, because evidently her mother had rain barrels. And mm-hmm. It was a not uncommon thing to have, I guess, back then. What got us away from this? This makes absolutely perfect sense to me. From so many different angles, it's almost ludicrous to even be sitting here talking about this as a new concept. It's not new. But what got us away from it?
Well, there's a lot of energy required going to the spring and getting water and coming back, and that's why our great-grandparents had rain barrels, just to save on that energy cost of sending somebody all the way down to the spring and get water back. Well, with electricity, water collection got a lot easier for us, and then it didn't make as much sense economically to have a rain barrel at that time. And really now the economics are a little bit weak on it, but again, the ecological value of it is one of the reasons that we do it. And plus, again, with the restrictions on municipal water, you may not be able to tap into municipal water to use it for gardening and establishing plants and things like that.
So after a couple of rains like we had yesterday and the day before that and the day before that, where I have this fountain in the backyard that I had emptied and put the plug back in it, and it's full. And it takes about, I guess, 5 or 6 gallons to fill the bottom, and it's full, and it was full after one rain. So after a couple of rains like that in your cistern, if it never rained again, how long would the water in that thing last?
It would depend on how much we were applying, but it'll do just what David was saying. It'll get us through 2 or 3 weeks. And what prompted us to apply for the grant was last fall when the water restrictions were put in place, and we couldn't plant our fall greens garden.
Right.
The most important thing we grow in terms of nutrition per square foot is our greens and collards. And we wanted to set a good example, and so we weren't going to use city water to do it. There were water restrictions going on. Mm-hmm. It's not the same as watering a lawn. We're growing food, but still, we have to set the bar pretty high.
So, how do you get the water out of these things, and what kind of water pressure do you get? I mean, can you use a hose and a nozzle when you turn the tap on the water the rain barrel?
Well, again, it depends on how you do it. You've got the gravity assist, and gravity is only going to give you just a few pounds per square inch. But if you put a pump in there, you can get anything. The cistern I was talking about in South Charlotte has around 50 pounds of pressure. It's just as good as turning on a faucet anywhere else.
So you turn it on as you're going to use it, and then you turn it off when you're done. So it doesn't.
Well, it's automatic pump. Okay. They've got automatic pump controller on that one. But if you're using a rain barrel, a lot of times I'll just go in the top of a rain barrel, and that's easier than turning on something and letting it run out. It's a lot quicker. Just drop your bucket down in the top of it, and seconds you're out of there.
What about aesthetics? If you want to do this around your house, we'll talk about later where to get rain barrels and all that kind of stuff. But the aesthetics of it and the difficulty of it, because you know, you have to adapt your downspouts. You can't just put it on the outtake of the downspout that sits on the ground. You've got to chop off your downspout and insert it into the barrel, right?
It works easier to do it that way. There's other ways of getting it done, but that's a simple way not an unreasonable way of getting it done, is to put that in there. The aesthetics, a lot of times on a rain barrel, tree rain barrel, you're using a little bit of screening, but you can put a cistern in the ground. You can bury it if you're going to pump back out of it.
Mm-hmm. And there are some on the market that really are not unpleasing aesthetically. I've seen some that are sand color that sort of could form right around the corner of a house. So I think that the market is starting to address that.
And of course, in this part of the country, we've got the Gaffney peach. I mean, why not just really show it off, you know?
I kind of think if you put that up in your backyard, the neighborhood association might have a thing or two to say about that. But that is a cistern, isn't it?
Yes,
they pump
it
the
is.
Water up into
yes, it.
It doesn't collect the rainwater. They pump it up in there.
Now, about getting that water out, though, just let me say that we also have a pump in the Urban Ministries garden. But that's one of the only gardens that we put our cisterns in that has a pump. For the most part, we just get the cistern up off of the ground about 2 feet. And that gives you more pressure for gravity feed.
Okay.
And if you're on a level ground, gravity will usually do it for you.
Okay. That's Pam Rook, who is the research editor of Organic Gardening Magazine. Don Volkelheide is with us from Urban Ministry Center. And David Goforth is the cooperative extension agent up in Cabarrus County. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about organic gardening. And you should see some of the fruits and vegetables they've organically grown here. We'll come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our progress made possible in part today by Heartwood Tree Service, human beings caring for and climbing Charlotte's trees. Info at heartwoodtree.com or 704-525-3066. And by It's Just Lunch, dedicated to arranging informal first dates for busy professionals. Details available at itsjustlunch.com. Well, the newspaper business is having some serious problems, not just here, but around the country. Readership is declining, therefore ad revenues are declining. Fewer young people are reading the paper. That's caused a problem for newspapers, and it does pose as a threat pose a threat to democracy as well, because newspapers have traditionally been these massive news-gathering organizations. Nobody does it like newspapers. We're going to talk about the state of the newspaper business today and what it means to the business and to our democracy with the editor of the Charlotte Observer and others tomorrow at 9.
Iran says he had test-fired a series of missiles, including one powerful enough to reach Israel. The U.S. is pushing ahead with plans for a missile defense shield to counter Iran and has reached a new deal with the Czech Republic. The Diane Rehm Show, Thursday.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, here on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE.
Some stories are just hard to believe.
The seemingly superhuman power to change the weather.
It's a lump of clay. Who would think that this you could turn into donuts or you could turn it into hamburgers?
To them, a hot air balloon is a huge predator.
Making sense of things that seem not to. Weekdays on All Things Considered from NPR News.
With regional news, weather, and traffic, weekday afternoons from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting in our Spirit Square studio with Don Bokelhide, Community Gardening Program Director at Urban Ministry Center and a contributor to Organic Gardening Magazine. The research editor of that magazine has joined us from Pennsylvania. She's down here today to help dedicate the cistern at the Urban Ministry Center, Pam Rook. And David Goforth is a cooperative extension agent in Cabarrus County. We're talking about cisterns and rain barrels, but we're also talking about organic gardening, why you do it, how you do it, and how you do it in a drought. Because you're not using chemicals and you're not using these chemical fertilizers and pesticides when you organically grow plants, be they bushes or shrubs or food products, does it require more work? Does it require special attention? Does it require extra effort on the part of the gardener?
I would say it requires more knowledge, but beyond that, you can organically grow. If you know what insects you're dealing with, what pesticides you're dealing with, if you know the techniques of getting your soil very well, you can work with organically as easy as you can conventional. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Define organic. What is exactly does it mean?
Well, organic is, very simply stated, gardening without chemicals. It's caring for the soil in natural ways, using compost, rather than buying a fertilizer and putting it in your soil. It's from a gardener's standpoint, it's using only organic products or even no products, no pesticides, using natural systems to take care of your pests.
A natural system would be what? Planting the right crops adjacent to each other so they scare off the pests?
They don't actually scare it off, but that we do a lot of that. Insectary borders is something we always do in our garden. In other words, we plant a lot of flowers that will attract a lot of insects. Anything in the carrot family, Queen Anne's lace, dill, will attract hoverflies, which will lay their eggs on broccoli plants, which will then become larvae, which eat all the aphids.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And that's just one example of ways that you can bring in insects that you want to take care of insects that you don't want.
This seems like you have to know a lot. I guess this is where your magazine comes in and where people like you come in, David, with
exactly.
Your expertise from the Cooperative Extension Service. How many farmers in our area are doing this?
Well, you can overthink it too, Mike, as far as the knowledge thing is. Our grandparents, great-grandparents, a lot of times they would use techniques we would call organic today because that's what they had available. The synthetic pesticides that we don't use in organic systems were invented World War One, World War Two, when they were using the nerve agents and stuff in the wars, figured they could also use those on insects and things. So it doesn't take as much knowledge, perhaps, as it's not like you need a college degree to garden on that.
It does help to buy an organic gardening magazine now and again, though.
But you do have to know. There's some basic rules. I would never have known about the hoverflies. I don't even know what they are.
You don't have to know what. The number one thing is to start with a good soil. You get your good soil, you can grow a good crop, and then if an insect gets on it, and these tomatoes, for example, they were caterpillars that started eating some of the other tomatoes, and they just did not thrive. Mm-hmm. Because if you've got good products here, you've got plenty of chemicals in there that'll keep the insects from diving in and really thriving on your products.
I think, Mike, one thing that happens in an organic garden is you think ecologically. You're learning not just from books, but from your garden. That's the reason to get out there and do it, to try it, and to think of gardening as a dance rather than as a medical problem. You are going in, you're in a partnership with nature. You have a good, strong soil. Therefore, you have healthy plants. Those healthy plants give healthy crops that sustain you in a healthy way. I think that was Rodale's original idea, that he was interested in health. That's what got him into it. And there, what your organization does, like Prevention Magazine and these other things. So we talked about insects. They're not all bad.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about chemicals. There are naturally occurring chemicals. That's what David's talking
about. When you talk about the chemicals plants, in the tomato, these are natural chemicals.
Natural chemicals the plant has developed to defend itself.
Okay.
Exactly. So,
and I think it's especially important at the Urban Ministry Center because we don't really go for chemical dependency. So organic is the way for us.
I know that David, you talk about getting people's food IQ back to where it used to be. A little while ago, generations ago. Is that what we're talking about here, understanding how this works? Or is there more to it than that?
I would say, again, it's just good food. If you, and I'm not real hepped on organic. I don't like the word. I don't use the term for the things I sell at the farmers markets myself. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of things about organic that will make very good product. And so it's a good food versus poor food. And basically, bottom line, if it looks good and it smells good and tastes good, then it can be very good food. And that's the reason now, organic gardening, not using synthetic fertilizer. You use too much nitrogen, you pump it up, you've got less quality. It's not as good a food for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you use compost, that's going to make better food. And so just start off trying to get good soil, grow good food, and if the insects take some of it, let them have it. They're eating the sorry stuff. You can eat the good stuff.
I'm going to come back to this good soil because it keeps coming up. I want to find out what that means. But I'm going to amplify or clarify something that you just said. I just understood you to say that you're not necessarily a purist when it comes to organic gardening. You don't really care whether people garden organically or use fertilizer or chemicals, et cetera. But you just want things to come
Good quality.
Garden. So you can do. Can you do both? Should you do both?
Well, let me give you an example here on these blueberries. The only reason these blueberries cannot be called organic is because 2 years ago, I sprayed some Roundup about 10 feet away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, they've had no synthetic fertilizer. They've had no pesticides whatsoever. They don't meet the definition of organic, but they're very good food. I think if you'll take these home, they'll be some of the best blueberries you've ever eaten.
Mm.
And the quality is the bottom line, and however it takes you to get to that point, which again, organic does a very good job. Synthetic fertilizers, the trouble is just making stuff too big. You know, you can grow things with compost, with cover crops, and they won't pump up real big. And the more they pump up, the less vitamins, the less nutrients, the less antioxidants they've got per bite.
You're sitting here with one of the biggest slicing tomatoes I've ever seen, and that is an organically grown tomato, is that correct?
Actually,
I think it weighs 10 pounds. it's a big tomato.
It wouldn't meet the definition, but it is pesticide-free, and it's very quality. You'll taste that one.
Okay.
You'll find it may not be the very best tomato, but it's going to be one of the top 10.
So there's obviously a trade-off. It's more work. You have to have some knowledge when you garden organically, or at least you learn from your garden, or you learn from magazines and books. You learn from people like Dave.
No, I don't know that anybody agreed that it was more work. I don't know
really?
That it
okay.
is
no,
I, more work.
That's not what I heard, okay?
And the other thing that you said that I don't know that any of us would agree with. I know I wouldn't. You said that gardening originally, when you first introduced us, was frustrating. And I don't know about David and Don, but I consider gardening a joy.
Okay.
And not frustrating. You know,
well, I actually thought about that when I wrote that yesterday. I thought there are going to be people who disagree with this.
Want to come take my class? Or David's got some great things. But I think another thing that might clarify, I agree 100%, Pam. I also think it might be useful to make a distinction between organic in terms of home gardeners and community gardeners, and organic in terms of those little stickers in the market, the certified organic stuff that you buy.
Is there a difference?
There's a big difference. For working backwards, the farmer that wants to get that sticker has to go through a very exacting process. And just like David was talking about, you spray pesticide of the wrong type anywhere even near that garden, it won't qualify. An inspector comes in, there's all kinds of record keeping. It's based on a very clear list of do's and don'ts. You can certainly use certain things, you can't use other things. In home organic gardening, it's a much bigger tent. It almost goes back to the earliest definition, I guess, of organic as being holistic, looking at the whole picture. And so within organic gardening, in terms of gardeners, we all will discuss all kinds of stuff. I mean, and some people will, you know, like have 12-step programs because they're still using Miracle-Gro. But, you know, it's a wide thing. The most important thing is to get out there and garden and learn to grow some of your own food. Look at this. Look at that beautiful tomato, Mike.
Yeah,
you, I mean, and that's coming off of David's. There's no carbon footprint there. David walks out the front of his house, picks that tomato, goes and slices it, and you can't beat the flavor.
Your original editor, Mr. Rodale, who started Organic Gardening Magazine, became interested in this more earth-friendly way to grow fruits and vegetables, which he coined, I believe he coined the term organic, for lack of a better term.
In this country, he did. I believe it was used in England before that.
Okay, so he brought it to these shores and used it in general use in publication. Back in the late 30s, early 40s, why then? This is before we had these factory farms that we have now. This is before when we had this mass amount of pesticide that you could go to a Home Depot and buy. You can't. Yeah. There were no Home Depots back then. Why then?
That's a good question. Interestingly enough, I think he came to gardening through composting. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but I've read some of his early writings, and he was very interested in the method of composting they used in India, and he brought that to this country. So I think he came to organic gardening through looking at the soil and, you know, and looking at ways to build soil. And also from a health standpoint, organic gardening started as a page in Prevention Magazine, I believe. Let me check that. Yeah, started as a page in a health magazine. So he came at it from the standpoints or from the points of view of health and soil.
Pam Rook is the research editor for Organic Gardening Magazine. Dan Bokelheide is a contributor to that magazine, but also the Community Gardening Program Director at Urban Ministry Center, where tonight they will dedicate a cistern to collect rainwater that they got some financial help from Organic Gardening Magazine and others for. David Goforth is a cooperative extension agent from Cabarrus County. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or charlottetalks@wfae.org if you'd like to send us an email. As the research editor of Organic Gardening Magazine, you have been described as a classic field researcher. You are out there growing things using organic techniques, but you're also testing seeds and new and heirloom seeds. After all, the heirloom vegetables and fruits are things that have been around forever. What are you learning new things about them by testing heirloom seeds?
You need to grow to find out how things compare to each other. Mm-hmm. We also have test gardens around the country.
Okay.
Don is one of our test gardeners. In fact, our North Carolina test gardener. We have one in Washington State. We have two in California. We have one in Missouri. They're all over the country. So a plant that will act one way in Pennsylvania might act another way altogether in California.
Wow.
So we are a national magazine, so when we endorse a plant or a product, we want to be able to tell people
it'll grow in your area.
Where it works.
Mm-hmm. What are you learning, Don?
Well, one thing, we're all connected through email with each other, and we share notes. And one thing I'll say is, North Carolina is a great place to garden. We all should be gardening because I'll get, well, from the Rocky Mountains, they're still freezing that they can't plant a thing, and I've got tomatoes ripening, you know? It's like we're just so blessed here. 280-plus growing days.
Almost the whole year, isn't it?
Well, with a little bit of work, you can grow pretty much year-round. We've got great agents like David who gets it about working ecologically. I think everybody here ought to garden. We're learning all kinds of things. Let's see, what's one thing that we've learned recently?
We're learning a lot about how it is to garden in Las Vegas.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
What are they growing, cactus?
Well, no. She has a vegetable garden just like the rest of us.
Wow.
And she can tell us which tomatoes will thrive when it's 130 degrees outside.
Wow.
How else would we ever know that?
She goes out to her garden with her candy thermometer. It's Leslie Doyle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Our test gardener there. And it was 140 degrees in her garden.
Oh, my word. Some people like to grow flower gardens. Others like vegetable gardens. Would it be beneficial to both gardens, to have both gardens in proximity to each other, to have a flower garden and a vegetable garden?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, for the reason that I talked about earlier, in that you want to bring a lot of diversity of insects into your garden. You don't want to just feed the pests by having, you know, four rows of tomatoes. You want to have the pest insects as well as the beneficial insects, the ladybugs, the lacewings, the hoverflies. And by putting flowers, you will be drawing them, and also the birds. A row of sunflowers can do a lot to bring in the birds, which will be scouting for pests.
Do you mix them in amongst themselves, or do you have a flower garden over here and a vegetable garden over there?
I mix. You can do whatever you want. That's the nice thing about gardening.
I think it would be helpful to get away from the concept of a flower garden and a concept of a vegetable garden. A lot of the vegetable gardens out there, people will plant them rows 30 inches apart. Mm-hmm. And the reason they plant rows 30 inches apart is because that's how wide it takes a mule to get down through there. We don't have mules in Dilworth, you know. So,
well, there are some, but, well.
Okay. Around our home, we have the soil, and let's manage it. Let's put fruit that's useful for the birds, useful for wildlife. Let's put things that are useful for us, both herbs and edible, different things like that. We need to get away from the concept of here is my flower garden, here is my vegetable garden.
And this ties into something we talked about last week. We did a program on growing native plants as opposed to bringing in these exotic plants that are not natural to the area, because it harms the, it certainly upsets the apple cart in terms of the ecosystem, because you're eliminating plants that are friendly toward native insects, and you're bringing in possibly insects that are not friendly toward other native plants. When you're planting these organic gardens, are you encouraging people to stick to things that grow here? And if you're doing a test garden for this magazine over here, you're probably planting things that are not necessarily native. You're checking them out. So talk about how this all comes together.
We're lucky at the center because we've got enough space to both landscape and grow a productive garden. I'm going to echo what David said. I think these divisions are very artificial. In the upcoming edition of Organic Gardening Magazine, there's a profile of a professor at Clemson University who has done work with heirlooms, mm-hmm. and he purposefully mixes everything in that garden, and it's stunning. It's a beautiful garden and a very productive garden. David Bradshaw is his name. And you just need to move in that direction. We do that in our vegetable garden, but in the vegetable garden, we're mostly growing stuff to eat, as well as flowers to pick, and they look beautiful. But in our landscaping, we're moving toward native plants as much as we can. So what we've got in our whole area is a balanced ecosystem. Some of it's highly productive. A vegetable garden is a highly productive place where you're going to be managing the soil differently. Mm-hmm. But we also have places that we let alone. We allow the natural landscape to assert itself.
Organic fruits and vegetables in the grocery store are more expensive for some reason than others. I could ask you why, but I think I know the answer. But is it worth the trade-off to grow it yourself? It takes more effort than it does to go to the grocery store and buy an organic tomato if you grow it yourself organically. Is it worth the trade-off, and can you feed yourself if you have a garden large enough to grow a lot of different fruits and vegetables? Can you really put those on your table every single night?
A person might, but my concept is that in our urban gardens, we need to do the antioxidants. There's very few of us who are getting enough antioxidants and vitamins and minerals in our diets, and we put things in our urban garden that are very high in antioxidants, things like the blueberries, things like the muscadine grapes, not as heaped on native. I mean, tomatoes are native to the Andes or something, but I'll grow them in my garden. So,
okay, well, we'll come back and get some more tips on that and other things about organic gardening with our three guests in a moment. And when we come back, Mary Kelly will get on the air as well. She's holding on the phone. Our program is made possible in part today by Creative Loafing, a Charlotte alternative weekly newspaper, now with expanded food and arts coverage. More information available online at charlotte.creativeloafing.com. and by Master Builder Fellowship for the Built Environment, a residential and commercial design build group using energy-efficient techniques for more than a decade to harmonize with the environment, on the web at masterbuilderfellowship.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Iran has test-fired a series of missiles, while the Bush administration continues its pursuit of a missile defense shield to counter Iran. They'll talk about that with a panel of folks in the 10 o'clock hour. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, Martin Schramm, an award-winning journalist and author, exposes mistreatment of American servicemen and women by the Department of Veterans Affairs. He has a book about this called Vets Under Siege, and a nationally syndicated column which appears in more than 400 newspapers, including the Washington Post. He's on the air at 11 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And we'll come back and talk more about organic gardening, and we have a lot of emails here about cisterns, so we'll talk some more about that as well, rain barrels and the like, in about 60 seconds.
It was probably one of the most scary yet points in my life where I had to tell you that I loved you and that I cared about you and how I felt. And I know if I didn't share it at that moment, I just felt like I would never get that time back ever again.
Everyday stories of love, loss, triumph, and remembrance can all be found at our StoryCorps Charlotte archive on our website, wfae.org/StoryCorpsCharlotte.
You know, 90.7 FM WFAE keeps you company during your morning and evening commutes with the latest news and in-depth analysis. We appreciate that you rely on us as a trusted companion, and we rely on your financial support in order to keep the great stories and refreshing perspectives coming every day here on WFAE. We really are only as good as the company we keep. Thanks for spending time with us.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about organic gardening and getting rain water collected and used in the garden, etc., with the three experts on the topic. Don Bokelhide is Community Gardening Program Director with Urban Ministry Center. Pam Rook, the Research Editor for Organic Gardening Magazine, a Rodale publication. They've helped Urban Ministry Center get a cistern, big one, that'll be dedicated tonight. And David Goforth is the Cooperative Extension Agent for Cabarrus County. Our caller that I mentioned before going into the break has gone away, so we can't take her call. We'll hear from David in just a second. A couple of emails that take us back a little bit to the cistern things that we were talking about at the beginning of the show. Might have missed this writer says, but how do you deal with mosquito control? Are all these rain barrels, all these collectors of rainwater covered so that they don't become nests for mosquitoes?
That would be a better option, would be to screen out the mosquitoes from the top. Now, a lot of the cisterns are completely enclosed, and the mosquitoes don't have any way to lay their eggs. A lot of your rain barrels are open, and if you'd put a screen over that, the mosquitoes, they won't stand up on top of the screen and drop their eggs all the way down, and that will pretty much keep them out. And if they did hatch, they wouldn't be able to get back out. So,
except with the water flow.
It's not a real problem all with right. that. Now, sometimes you have these open barrels that do have mosquitoes in there, and sometimes you take a little bit of food-grade oil or something, put it on the top, and that'll suffocate them.
Ken in Charlotte wants to know, is there any risk of chemical runoff from shingles and bird droppings from roof runoff being used to water vegetable gardens?
The first step in a system, you were asking why we had a more expensive system? It's to avoid exactly that. We've got something called a first flush diverter. So the very first water that comes off our roof is diverted, and that takes the wash of bird droppings and whatever else. Not much is coming off our roof, by the way. It's pretty clean. And then after that, it fills up kind of a filter, and then it's filtered into the tank. So what gets into the tank has been pre-filtered.
Bird droppings occur throughout the garden, so why is it a concern that they would be on the roof?
I'm not terribly concerned about that problem. It's more debris we're concerned about.
Okay. Justin in Concord says, don't let David Goforth go without mentioning his blog, which is pretty entertaining. What do you do? Are you a comedian? What's the deal here?
I just able to write a few things. I think sometimes I see a little irony in things that other people don't notice.
I see a future for you at Organic Gardening Magazine. Let's put your headphones back on. We'll take a call here from David, who's somewhere on I-85. David, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I have to say that I absolutely adore and love reading Rodale Talks, the Organic Gardening. I have been reading that for a long, long time, been collecting the books and applying a lot of the information that they provide.
Good.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Okay. Just a little thought on the rain barrel that I don't know if somebody's collecting water for the cistern, but I use a rain barrel to water my garden and to keep the mosquitoes out because I live in the Northeast. I throw two goldfish in and it just eats all the larvae, so I don't have to worry about that. I just wanted to say that organic gardening is the only way to go.
Thank you for the compliment, and that's a very creative solution.
So where in the Northeast do you live?
I live in Maine.
Wow. So you're just driving through?
Yeah, I drive all across the country, and this year I didn't get a chance to plant a garden, but next year I definitely will.
Well, it's because your growing season is about a week and a half, isn't it?
That's right.
But the days are long.
I incorporate a lot of techniques that the organic gardening, you know, cold frames and cold frames actually do work up there. Yeah.
What is a cold frame? Just out of curiosity.
A cold frame?
Mm-hmm.
I recycle a lot, so I go around and collect old windows and build building a cold frame, I can grow parsnips and carrots and things right in the ground in the wintertime.
All right. Wow.
Yeah, but anyways.
Okay, well, David, thank you for your call. I appreciate it very much, and drive carefully. Southern drivers are strange. No, they're not. It's the northern drivers that are strange. You're endangering our lives by being on the phone on our highway. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. What about buying? How important is it if you're going to buy a piece of organic produce from the grocery store, does it matter where it came from? Does it matter if it comes from a local farm 10 miles away or 20 miles away or from Argentina? As long as that label is on there that says organic, does it matter?
To me, it matters.
Because?
We all need to be thinking about our impact on the earth. That's part of stewardship. And I see at the Urban Ministry Center how that's reflected in how we as a society deal with the least fortunate among us. So the more parsimonious we are, the better stewards we are, the better we can help, the better we can take care of our earth. Something that's coming from Argentina or Chile has a huge energy load with it. Flying that organic apple here, well, it's a trade-off where I think you should look at Hendersonville, where they're growing apples mm-hmm. closer to us. It's local is as important as an organic sticker to me. It's very important to work with local growers. I think David's doing a lot of this in his county, especially for fresh things. And then work with local growers to help them become more organic and more ecologically sound.
This is all part of it, I think, slow food movement. We've been accustomed in the last 20 years or so to be able to buy a tomato or a watermelon or a cantaloupe all year long. And I can remember a time when you didn't buy tomatoes in January because they simply weren't available in the grocery store. Because they weren't floating here from around the world. If you wanted to do this, how difficult would it be to do this, just to buy locally? I mean, is local produce that well marked in the grocery stores around here, or is it best just to go to the farmer's market every week?
I do like farmer's markets, and we have set it up where we have five sites that are open during the week, starting with the Harrisburg market, the Wyckoff market, the Concord market. We've got one in Kannapolis. And so we do have the local farmers markets, but it's mostly the fact that your variety is not as good if you try to buy it locally. And that's why people want, with low energy cost, we can get these grapes from Chile in the off season. Mm-hmm. If we were just trying to do it locally, our options would be cut down quite a bit. But I still think that as energy costs go up, that will become more reasonable, and people just quit making those decisions. They'll just quit buying the strawberries out of season. They'll just quit buying the grapes out of season, and things will become more local on that. And I think maybe we could help that along if we knew a little bit about what is local, what eating local would amount to.
Okay. Sharon in Charlotte writes, could the guest possibly recommend what would be the best way, the best plants to garden if you have a very small area to plant, such as a patio? I live in a condo townhome and currently garden mostly in pots.
Well, I can answer that. Greens. Greens in pots are great. And you can grow a lot of lettuce in a pot. And if you continually seed it through the season, mm-hmm. you can have it almost all summer, depending on where you live. Where we are in Pennsylvania, if you're seeding every 2-3 weeks, you can have fresh greens all summer long.
How big a pot do you need to grow
lettuce? You don't need that big. I would say a 20-inch pot. You can grow a lot of greens in a 20-inch diameter pot.
Wow.
Or a window box.
A couple of plugs. Go down to visit Renfro's Hardware down in Matthews. He grows lots of vegetables in pots. David Blakely does. Okay. And so you can see what's possible. It's amazing what you can grow in a pot. And the other recommendation is look around for the nearest community garden. You can go get a garden spot. Park and Recreation is starting to offer them in more and more places. Have a little 10 by 10 or 20 by 20 plot and grow your vegetables in the sun. Get a nice break. Meet some nice people. Mm-hmm. And then put some flowers on your condo deck.
Okay. Priscilla says, we garden organically and continue to have problems getting rid of the squash borer. Can you offer some suggestions? Appreciate any info you might be able to offer. David, you're on. You look a little puzzled.
Yeah, squash borer, spinosad is a new product we've got out there that, again, if you'll have a very good soil, that'll help some. High potassium levels will help some. Some people put wood ashes there to get the high potassium levels around their plants. But beyond that, if you will use the spinosad, which is actually a byproduct of the rum industry in Jamaica, I'm sort of curious on who went down there and discovered that was a good insecticide, but it is available now locally and can be used. It is considered to be an organic pesticide.
There are another couple of things that you can think of. Now, this comes from David Bradshaw. First of all, get your squash in as early as you can so that it has a good, you know, amount of growth on it before the borers show up. Usually two borer hatches here.
Not for me. Early makes a difference on squash.
Right. Early makes a big difference. And check your varieties. There's one variety I've had very good luck with the past couple of years, Pagoda Gold. It resists the borers because I think it has a hairier stem. What happens with these borers, they are a large moth, and you'll see them buzzing around. Uh-huh. They lay their eggs on the plant, and it bores right into the stem and eats it from the inside out. It's truly hideous.
Okay.
So anyway, squashes and winter squashes will have this too. They have a tougher stem, and so they can't get a hold of, you know, get into the plant, destroy it.
Okay.
What old timers did was they would put the runners of the squash under soil so it would form new sets of roots as it spread through the garden. And you keep the mulch away from your squash plants because they like to lay their eggs right there. Most everything in an organic garden is mulched very heavily, but it's maybe not such a good idea with your squash plants because of borers here.
You keep saying good soil. I meant to come back to this earlier in the program. Good, strong soil. What does that mean, and where do you get it, or how do you develop it?
Well, you build it yourself. A lot of times it's the carbon-nitrogen ratio within the soil is what allows you to have very good fruit. You need to get the pH right. You need to get a good carbon source within the soil. That'll give you a good biological start on the soil. And those type of things will allow the plant to grow normally, you know, as opposed to the synthetic fertilizers. A lot of times you're getting too much nitrogen with those. That's one of the major problems with the synthetics.
Brucey in Charlotte says, a few months ago I bought a big old black rain barrel, which is tucked behind a big boxwood. Someone told me that there's a grant program that will reimburse you part of the cost of a rain barrel in Mecklenburg County. Is that true? And if so, who do you contact about that?
Yes, the Soil and Water Conservation District has a grants program for rain barrels. It's a terrific thing. It's a cost share. And you can contact Mary Staubel at the Soil and Water Conservation District. It's on the county page under Land Use and Environmental Services.
Okay, Mary Staubel. And we also have an email that says, since you're talking about collecting water and using a rain barrel, I wanted to let you know that the Master Gardeners of Union County are having a pre-order rain barrel sale. Orders will be taken through July 21st. The pickup date is July 26th from 9:30 to 2 at the Union County Agricultural Center. And you can get more information and order by going to unionmg@co.union.nc.us. That's impossible. We'll put that on our we'll put that on our website later today, or you can call 704-283-3822. Let me go to Phyllis, and then I want to talk about the Urban Ministry Center very quickly here. Phyllis in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to tell Charlotte about a local farmers market, a small farmers market that is actually local growers from the area. They are not resellers like some of the larger farmers markets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's over in South End at the corner of Camden and East Kingston across the street from Fat Burrito.
And how often are they up and operating?
It's Tuesday afternoons from 4 to 7 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to 12. And you can get everything from local honey to locally made goat cheese, bread, and all kinds of vegetables.
Okay,
so it's a great little spot.
You're getting nods of recognition and approval here from our two local guests. Thanks for calling, Phyllis. I appreciate it very much. Talk about, Don, your experience at Urban Ministry working with homeless people in an organic garden. What has that been like, and what has it done for the homeless who are involved in that?
Gardens are transformative. They're healing. They are a kind of human behavior that goes back a very long time. And everyone, I think, benefits by having a place to garden. And if you're living under a bridge, you're living in the woods, you've got no place to garden.
Yeah.
And on the simplest level, that's what we're providing at the center. We have some space in our landscape. And so the neighbors, we call those people that come to us neighbors, mm-hmm. as in love your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide neighbors a place to grow some food, some flowers, and to just enjoy the landscape. Move mulch around. We moved a lot of mulch yesterday.
Yes, we did.
We've got services at the center. We have a soup kitchen where we feed people. And, of course, the obvious thing is that we grow food, and it's very popular food. When the fresh stuff comes out of the garden, people just devour it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very proud because they help grow it themselves. But the biggest thing, Mike, is that people who work in the garden work side by side. They're not getting something like a handout, like, you know, getting free something. They're not getting counseling where I sit across the desk from you. You got the problems. I got the answers. I'll help you. No, we're working side by side. In front of a tomato, tomatoes don't care about humanity. We're all equal in the eyes of a tomato.
So you're giving people a sense of equality and you are giving them a sense of self-respect.
Well, it's your trade. It's conversation.
Yeah.
The most important thing you can do to transform a human being's life is converse with them, to really listen. And in the garden, I'm not there to solve people's problems, but I'm there to listen. I'll hear about growing up on a farm and, you know, down in Lancaster County and how I used to follow the plow and how I learned from my dad this and what happened in my life that and what my daughter's doing now and how my husband just threw me out and on and on and on. It's a long, extended conversation in the garden. Mm-hmm. The other day we were out there. People were exchanging jokes back and forth. I had a master composter volunteer helping. It was a wonderful scene of exchange, the human side of a garden.
And tonight they're dedicating the cistern that has been made possible by Organic Gardening Magazine and some other organizations as well. If you don't have a cistern, if you don't have rain barrels, and we are under water restrictions, what's the best way to keep your organic garden or your garden healthy and thirst-free this time of year? Very quickly.
Well, some mulch will help some. Mm-hmm. Some organic matter in the soil will help hold more moisture, but the bottom line is plants do need water.
Right.
And I think one thing that organic growers that learn out of books do sometimes is crowd their plants. Because out in the West, when organic gardening was first worked on in the 60s, they crowded plants together. Don't do that in a drought system. Give your plants a lot of space. Some of your heirlooms actually like that extra space. So don't go for real tight spacing.
That's it. Go ahead, quickly.
The other thing that you should do is get a soaker hose.
Ah, and water in the morning. Soaker hoses and water in the morning. Pam Rook from Organic Gardening Magazine, Don Volkelhide from Urban Ministry Center, and David Goforth, Cooperative Extension Agent from Cabarrus County. Thank you all very much.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And our progress made possible in part today by 123NC.com. Instant access to North Carolina criminal records and nationwide background checks. Criminal records can be searched instantly online at 123NC.com. And by an Appalachian Summer Festival, June 28th through July 26th on the Appalachian State University campus in Boone. A month-long celebration of music, dance, theater, visual arts, and film. Details at appsummer.org.
My name is Mark Redler, a longtime NPR listener, and I enjoy Morning Edition very much. There's one year-long series you're doing now on climate change I think is not only really informative, but I really like the fact that parts of that series are being carried on Morning Edition because that's the time of day I listen. Morning Edition is my source for not just information, but for a great way to start my day.
With regional news, weather, and traffic, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. Major daily newspapers throughout the country are in decline, and the Charlotte Observer is no exception. Fewer people are reading newspapers, choosing instead to get their news from the web and other sources. Most dailies have websites, but no one has been able to make money on them yet. In the meantime, cutbacks on personnel, stories, even page size is the order of the day. The editor of the Observer and others talk about the stark realities of the newspaper business when Charlotte talks. Tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Slight chance of showers and thunder showers this morning, and then again this afternoon, likely actually this afternoon, upper 80s, mid-60s tonight with possible rain and upper 80s tomorrow. It's 76 now at WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory, your NPR News source. From